This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscawain. Running is a sport which can make you feel as if you're flying on a good day and absolutely miserable on a day which is not so good. Still, millions of us run, according to the group Running USA, and millions more doubtless wonder why we do it. Jen Miller can relate to both. Her memoir is called Running, A Love Story. She is about to undertake her sixth marathon on Sunday, the New Jersey Marathon. But she was not always in love with the sport, and we'll hear her story. Also later this hour, we're going to chat with Roberta Gibb, who finished the Boston Marathon 50 years ago, a feat no other woman had accomplished up until that time. But first, we welcome Jen Miller to Radio Times.
Hi, hello.
Jen. Welcome back to Radio Times,
thank you.
I should say.
Happy to be back.
So you open your book with a couple of quotes, and I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly. Haruki Murakami, who says, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional, and we're going to get to running and suffering and joy. You are, after all, a marathoner. But let's start off with the fact that running wasn't always something you saw yourself doing.
Oh, gosh, no. I played sports like most kids in southern New Jersey or, you know, anywhere in this country. And running was something that we did to get ready for other sports. People used to call it conditioning. And
yeah, sure.
I would run to get ready for soccer and softball. You know, the goal was to run fast to first base, but we ran a lot as punishment if we did something wrong, the same way that we did push-ups or sit-ups. Thanks, Coach Haddonfield High School. But running, for its own sake, seemed incredibly tedious, boring, and painful. So why would I ever want to do it for the sake of doing it?
Yeah. Well, as you mentioned, you were an active kid, and I'm sure that your friends were active as well. But what did you observe about girls and young women in regards to body image when you were coming up?
Well, when I played soccer and softball in high school, my friends and I were all looked very different, and we all played, you know, that lends towards soccer, I think, at least at the high school stage. I was in the middle. I had a friend who was very chesty, but was very good at like blocking people, and someone who was like a willow who could run as fast as possible. That sort of changed when I went to college.
Yeah.
I went to school at the University of Tampa, which is a really great institution and university, and I'm a happy alumni, but it's also in Florida where people are naked a lot. And it was sort of a revelation as to, well, I don't know if I look like all those, I called them pool bunnies, because they would like smoke and drink Diet Coke at the pool, and I didn't look like
perfect.
That. Yeah. And, you know, spray tans and fake tans and all that sort of stuff. And I didn't look like that. I'm just, you know, I say that I'm like a brick.
but some of the women who you hung out with were struggling to maintain that. And as a matter of fact, you write in your book of one sorority sister who might well have been anorexic.
Probably. And I should say, you know, I maybe come down a little bit hard on the sorority culture, because there were also sports players that I knew who were doing the exact same thing. Because
sure.
In the late 90s, you were supposed to be as small as possible to be fit. That's different now. There's a lot of focus on strength and muscles and muscle tone and all that. But it was sort of a groupthink of put all these people together in a place where everybody's pretty much naked all the time, and you want to be as small as possible and do what you have to do. And for me, that would be to not eat for as long as possible during the day and drink a lot of coffee and work in my newspaper office and see what I could do.
You had something called the coffee plan.
The coffee plan, yeah, the coffee diet. And it didn't really work that well. I was tired and exhausted, but I was also the editor of my college newspaper and trying to go to graduate school. So there was all sorts of stuff going on that I just attributed it to that. And also, it's hot down there.
I mean, still, you weren't really thinking of running. How did you eventually get into and embrace it?
Well, I tried running in college, which is not something to do at 2 o'clock in the afternoon in Florida. I did a fitness boot camp when I came home to go to graduate school at Rutgers Camden, and eventually became a full-time freelance writer and did a boot camp for a story. And I thought, okay, this is interesting. And I pitched a story to a magazine where they paid me $750 to train for a 5K.
Okay.
And to use an online running coach to do it, which was like the newfangled thing at the time. And I did it. And I thought, well, maybe I should make this part of my regular routine.
So you completed the 5K.
I did.
I also read that, I don't know if it was this 5K, but you were wondering, what if I finish last?
I did. And because, it, you know, it's the first time.
You wondered
time,
that or
yeah.
you finished
oh,
last?
Oh, no, I didn't finish last. I, you know, this is something that new runners ask me all the time. What happens if I finish last? Well, you finished ahead of everybody else who didn't run that day. I actually finished third in my age group. I got a $5 gift certificate to a taco place where tacos were $6. And I got a mug. So I didn't finish last. I actually did pretty well. And I've never been able to beat that time.
Well, you'll always have it.
I'll always have it.
And just an aside, I actually finished last in a race once.
So did my mom in her first 5K. And you know what? They gave her a medal anyway.
You know, you get the medal. Right. My kids were horrified, I have to say. But there's a lesson in there someplace. It wasn't so bad. It was actually interesting because you have the guy in the bike, you know, the motorcycle
right,
behind you. So he's, you know, he kind of makes you run a little faster. But anyway, so does your ability to run on any given day, Jen, affect your writing?
Yes. The way that I've described it is that, you know, that space where you're about to fall asleep, but you're not asleep yet and weird things happen. Dali used to try to wake himself up in this stage by like letting a quarter fall or something. Running does that to me. People talk about runner's high. I don't get that. I get into the twilight once I get past 5 miles. And that's really where a lot of my ideas come from. A lot of time where I just chill out. I got a concussion last week, and the only way that I could feel better really was to go run because I didn't look at screens. Like, that's part of the benefit too, is it lets my mind sort of breathe and come up with these ideas, or let things come through that was being blocked by whatever else was blocking me. And there's a lot of segments of this book that the wording, especially there are sections where I'm running a marathon and what goes through your brain while you're running a marathon, that came to me while I was out running.
So you don't run with headphones? You don't have music in your ears?
I don't listen to music unless I'm on the treadmill. Sometimes I listen to podcasts, especially when I'm training for a marathon, because you're just spending so much time, like 10 hours a week on the road, and I get really bored with myself. But most of the time when I'm not training for a marathon, I just run by myself.
So you think there's more of a creative flow if you don't have something in your ears?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. And so you've said you haven't experienced the so-called runner's high. I'm wondering if it's when you feel you get to that point where you feel like you can run forever.
There is that point where you feel like you can keep going. And I had one of those on a training run for the New York City Marathon. And I ran 22 miles. I'm like, I should just run 4 more, which stunk because I actually got sick before the New York City Marathon and had a really hard time running. So, you know, it's just it happened on the wrong day.
Back to the Murakami quote. Suffering is optional. I think this was during your first marathon, which was the Philadelphia Marathon. And if you could, I'd like you to read for us a little bit from your book about how that race went. So we'll give you a second there to get the page open.
So this is near the end, the very end.
Of the Philadelphia Marathon.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Step, 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 bang, bang, bang. This didn't feel like running. It felt like hurling myself across nails, pain rocketing through my body with every motion. My hips gave up screaming. They wept quietly, along with my thighs and my shoulders and my back and my toes. Between miles 23 and 24, I saw two people taken off the course on stretchers. I didn't quite hit the wall. I wasn't running strong enough to crash into it. Instead, I crumbled. My legs stopped wanting to move. Just before mile 25, I saw two people I knew, the first ones aside from my M&M mule that I'd spotted in the entire race. They screamed and yelled, and I gave back a weak wave. At the 25-mile marker, I stopped to walk again. I thought I'd run the rest of the way, but my legs seized up and stopped me short. At mile 26, I stopped again. "Go, go, go! You're almost there!" a spectator yelled at me. I wasn't. Those last 0.2 miles stretched ahead like an unending spool of road, growing longer the more that I looked at it. I got mad. I didn't need to be shamed by spectators for walking. What were they doing that morning other than ringing cowbells and drinking coffee and enjoying what to them must have felt like a nice warm day, not hellfire? At the last 0.1 mile, I heard Nick, his mom, and sister screaming for me. He had finished and changed already. I didn't stop then, even though my body revolted at being pressed to move forward, and came across the finish with a lunge of relief.
So, have you been able to put suffering in a separate compartment and somehow not acknowledge it out on the road? Because it certainly sounds as if you were going through it there.
Yeah, that was my first marathon. And I say that racing doesn't necessarily get easier the more that you do it, but you sort of expect it more. Like, I'm going into this marathon on Sunday, not sure how it's going to be. And I'm pretty sure that it's going to hurt, but I'm ready for it. So I think there's sort of that expectation that it will hurt. And also knowing what's coming really makes a difference. Like I said, I ran the 2014 New York City Marathon and it didn't go well, but I knew that I would finish. And I think that makes a lot of difference, too.
So are marathoners a touch masochistic?
my publisher in my first two books said that they're antisocial, which I kind of agree with sometimes. But it's the ultra marathoners who he said really don't want to talk to anybody.
Yeah.
There's sort of a pain and release thing that goes on with running. Hmm. I don't want running to hurt. It just does sometimes. Yeah. And that's the best, you know, when you're running fast and get faster, that's the way that it happens.
Running events are hugely social events,
I find. They are.
At the beginning, it's like a big party.
It is. And at the end, and sometimes people want to take pictures while they're running. Don't do that. But I think that's a reason why so many people run so much, is because it's really a community thing, especially now because so many people do it.
Yeah. Let's get to some, well, we've got some tweets. One from Nate who asks, does your guest have any concerns about the long-term effects of endurance running, which many studies show have negative impact? And does she have any advice for a longtime treadmill runner who wants to transition to the road? So two questions there, really. Long-term effects of endurance running, your knees, your hips.
There's a lot of, you know, your tweeter, hi Nate, said that there are studies showing that running does long-term damage. There's an equal number of studies showing that it strengthens your bones. It doesn't hurt your knees. I have a hip thing that happens to me sometimes, and it's more of an imbalance. It's not because running. It's I have one leg that's shorter than the other. I really don't worry about it. I hope to be running until the day I die because I've never felt stronger and more fit mentally and physically than when I'm running.
And you've done both treadmill and road.
I have, especially in icy weather. If you've only run exclusively on the treadmill, the motion to run on the treadmill and the roads are slightly different. Some people will run faster on one versus the other. I will say take your time. Don't try to replicate your treadmill workout. If it's only just you run 1 mile on the road just to see how it feels and take a walk break, that's the best way to do it. It is a little bit harder on the roads because the surface isn't so springy. But just take it slow and you'll get out there.
Our guest for the entire hour is Jen Miller, who is author of Running a Love Story. She's running her sixth marathon on Sunday. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499 is the number. Radio Times at WHYY.org, the email address. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We have an email from Julie who asks, would you please ask your guest to speak about the changes and current trend in short races related to themes like mud runs and color runs? What do you think about that?
I have done a mud run. It's not something I care to do again, but
they're hard.
They are. I scraped up my leg pretty bad. They became very, very popular very fast. I think it's pulling back a little bit as the copycats sort of drop away. There's also concerns with races not being able to get insurance. A lot of those races are not allowed to take place in Philadelphia parks anymore. So there's sort of a shift going on with it. They're not something I personally would do, but I think they're a great entry into physical activity. The color runs, which are very popular, are not timed. And I know a lot of people who have done that first just to say, okay, well, I can do that, and then move on to timed races. A race that's becoming very popular now is the 1 mile road race. According to Running USA, the 64% growth in that race from 2010 to 2015. So that's an interesting trend, not so much focusing on marathons and ultra marathons, mm-hmm. but running very short, very fast. I did my first road mile in September, and I can see why. It was a great experience.
Well, and did you run it quickly?
I ran it in 6 minutes and 32 seconds. I had hoped to break 7 minutes, which was my time in high school in the mile. And I did it, and it was great, and it was wonderful.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Jen Miller is author of the memoir Running a Love Story. And later this hour, we'll be talking to Roberta Gibb as well. Bobby Gibb, the first woman to complete the Boston Marathon. And as always, the number to call, 888-477-9499. You can also send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. More of Radio Times straight ahead. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. We are talking about running this hour, why people lace up and head out and sweat and suffer and race and go back and do it again. Jen Miller is with us the entire hour of Radio Times. She is author of the memoir Running a Love Story, and she's also on the team which is writing the New York Times Well Running newsletter. If you'd like to jump in, the number is 888-477-9499. You can send us a note via email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Jen, let's touch on a serious note for a moment. 3 years after the bombing at the Boston Marathon, mm-hmm. this year's Boston went off without a hitch. Mm-hmm. It was heavily policed. So when you're out there doing marathons, what are you seeing, and are you thinking of security?
Yes. The 2013 New Jersey Marathon, which is the main race in Running a Love Story, happened less than three weeks after Boston. And I wrote a story for an upcoming issue of the magazine Meter, talking to the race director about looking back on that experience and just the way that security was so much different. I mean, the New Jersey Marathon starts in Monmouth Racetrack, so there was a limited who could go into the racetrack to the start. Like, my mom couldn't, she could have come in with me, but there were so many restrictions on bags and things like that. Bomb sniffing dogs, helicopters overhead, police everywhere. The finish line still on Sunday this year, no bags in the finish line. So there's a lot of security measures, which sort of make me feel more comfortable knowing what has happened before. It just, there's a surreal feeling that this thing that so many people do for wonderful reasons is a target. That first race, right, that 3 weeks after the bombing, it was a little bit unsure of what would happen.
You write about being worried about your mother.
Right.
Because I know she was there, but yeah, she's in the crowd waiting
for you. I tried to get her to not go to the finish line because that was who was attacked during the Boston Marathon bombing, were spectators. And I couldn't, you know, I love my mom. I didn't want anything to happen to her. But she was defiant and says, I'm not going to let them stop me. And she was there and everything went fine. So I think hopefully the more that these races go off without a hitch, the less it'll sort of be a damper on the day.
Okay. You talk about running the New Jersey Marathon following the destruction wrought by Hurricane Sandy. Describe what that experience was like.
Well, I wrote a story for the New York Times a couple weeks before the 2013 New Jersey Marathon, where the race director drove me over the course, and he had actually lost the first floor of his house. There was a giant trash pile near the finish line of the marathon where everything from teddy bears to doors to toilets were on it. Hmm. And it felt like you were driving, at least in that course, and then running through an open wound. But so many people were so happy that the race went on. The race is in the first Sunday in May. So it was sort of a precursor because everybody was nervous about how that summer season was going to go off. Like, sure. Are we ready? Are there enough rentals? What about traffic? What about the roads? So we were sort of the test case for it. And it really felt triumphant at the end, even though, you know, I'm coming up to the finish line and I noticed that the railings are still bent on the promenade in Long Branch. It was something that I thought about that day, but it reinforced why I was there running to do what I could to show that the Jersey Shore was strong and put money into the local economy and all that sort of stuff that people talk about with races. And it's a shame, though, because some of the places that I ran past 3 years ago are still empty. So it's a reminder of the suffering that's still there, too.
That was leading to my next question. When you run New Jersey on Sunday, 3.5 years after Sandy, what do you expect to find?
I expect to find more people, hopefully. Because the course will be slightly different because it had to be altered, obviously, because you couldn't go on boardwalks because there were no boardwalks. Although the Long Branch boardwalk just reopened a couple weeks ago, so I'm not sure if we're going up on it. There are sections of Oceanport and Monmouth that we couldn't run through because the streets were in bad shape. So I hope that it's more on the course as it originally was imagined. And more people and hopefully not too much sunshine.
Well, sunshine can really make it hard for a runner, even if it's a beautiful day. What does training for a marathon involve? How many hours?
When I'm running my most, it's about 11 hours a week. That's about 55 miles.
So what does that translate into in the day? Do you wake up and you do what, a 10-mile run?
It depends. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, when I was training my most, I was running 10 to 12 miles a day. Then there's also the preparing for the run and recovering from the run. I would take a lot of naps. I'd take a coffee nap after lunch where I'd drink a cup of coffee and immediately go to sleep. It works. I don't know why, but it totally does. And then I'd be able to get on with the rest of the day. Because I'm self-employed, I could sort of schedule those runs either first thing in the morning if I had a lot to do or before lunch if it was very cold in the morning. I didn't have to run in the freezing cold. Thank you, freelance writing. But it's a huge commitment, and trying to work your social life around it. And also, you know, this book promotion has been quite a challenge, but I'm almost at the finish line. I'm almost there.
Yeah. We were talking off mic a little bit ago about, you know, this is your sixth marathon coming up on Sunday and you're not sure you're going to go for it again. Do you hear that from other people who run marathons?
I hear it from myself. My running coach has said he'll, you know, after his last one, I'm never doing that again. And he's running the Pittsburgh Marathon on May 1st. So I think it's one of those things that you get really tired towards the end, and you can't think of starting this kind of quest again. And then you finish, and then
it's
you
a quest.
Yeah, it is a quest. And you finish, and you're like, well, what's my next race, sort of thing. I do it every time. I did it after every marathon I've run already.
Okay, so stay tuned, in other words. All right. So when you're at the start of a race, Jen, how do you avoid getting caught up in all the excitement that's there by going out too hard?
I like to be able to talk to somebody. And that's a pretty common piece of advice.
If I just kind of look at somebody and go, you, I'm talking to you.
Sometimes people are open to it. Sometimes they're in their own little world. But that's what I do. When I started this marathon, actually at the start of the New York City Marathon, I started talking to somebody in the corrals waiting to go off. And sometimes they just have questions, want to talk. They're nervous. I'm still nervous when I run a marathon, but not as nervous as I used to be. And if I can
keep up. What makes you nervous about it?
Oh, all the things that could go wrong.
I mean, the thought that you might not be able to finish, is that a big deal?
Just how is my body going to hold up? The 2014 New York City Marathon was extremely windy. So going over the bridge to start the race, like our bibs were starting to tear off. Like, oh my God, what happens if I lose my bib? Because they're going to think I'm a bandit and pull me off the course. Hmm. There's just a lot of nervous energy because you run less the 2 weeks before a marathon. So, you know, where does all that energy go? And you go to the starting line and you're ready to go, go, go. And there are just a lot of things that could go wrong.
All right. We've got some emails coming in. Kathleen asks, would you ask, Jen, if it's possible that running is not for everyone? I do lots of cardio and could swim forever. But every time I've tried running, it feels like my lungs are bleeding.
I can't swim. I mean, I can go in the ocean and swim, but to go on a pool and do laps, I have no interest in, and I'm terrible at it. So, no, running isn't for everybody. I think a lot of people who say they can't run who have never tried should try. But if biking or swimming or walking or hiking is your thing, that's totally great, too.
All right. And Carter sent us an email. Running seems like an identity to me. I'm a new runner and trying to figure the identity out. What sort of shift did you notice or do you notice, perhaps socially, as you became a runner or watched other people become a runner?
I think the first time I went into a running store and didn't feel like I didn't belong there. I thought, well, I'm a runner. I know people who run races and say they're not runners. I mean, it's really what you want it to be. Not to call you out, but you say you don't run marathons, but you're still a runner, right?
Oh yeah, and I'm a slow runner. And
but you're still a runner.
I am a runner. Some people might differ within my family. I get teased about it all the time because I am that slow. but I am a runner.
It's some people don't want to identify as a runner because they feel like they're not fast, so they don't do enough races. And I say, if you put on sneakers and you go run, you're a runner.
Yeah. So, do you recommend, Jen, that someone who is just starting and who has a race in mind go with a training plan?
I obviously had a unique situation where a magazine paid me to train with a coach. Mm-hmm. Since that time, Couch to 5K has become incredibly popular, and it's free. And I know so many people who got into running because of that.
You just find that online?
Yeah, it's online. Just Google it, and you'll find it. And it is the basics. It will get you off the couch and start running. My neighbor's doing it right now. I think that it's great because it starts you slow and it includes walking. So I would absolutely check that out. If you can go out and run 3 miles without training, that's great too. But if you're not sure where to start, that's definitely a good spot.
Yeah. You've experienced at least some downtime being injured and lived to write about it. There is actually such a thing as dead butt syndrome.
Dead butt syndrome. It's gluteus medius tendinosus. And it's the way that I describe it, felt like an ice pick was being driven into my hip. But the funny thing was, as soon as the doctor told me what I had, you have dead butt syndrome, I thought, well, I have a story there, so at least I have that. And I still have some hip problems, but I take care of that with sports massage.
Okay. So, but does being injured drive you crazy, though?
Yes.
To take some downtime?
Yes. I hurt my foot 2 weeks ago, and I had to take some time off during a crucial part in training, and then I got a concussion, so I had to take time off.
Mentally, what do you do to get around that?
Just fret.
That's not the answer.
I know it's not the answer, but I don't have a good answer.
Deep breathing. No.
I would walk.
Yeah.
Walk my dog more and just sort of try to catch up on things that I missed because I was running a lot. But it's very frustrating, especially knowing that May 1st is the day, and that's not going to change just because I'm hurt.
Sure. Whatever gets you through it.
Right.
Okay, so Jen Miller, in your book, you talk about your relationships with men. Mm-hmm. In one relationship, you dated an alcoholic who was sober at the time. Then he fell off the wagon. Steven turned into Steve. It seems like you lost yourself when you were with him.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had a poster of Jessica Alba on the wall. And
right.
You were, you know, becoming very thin. And so when you finally broke it off, you wrote, I spent a year and a half trying to prove I was enough for someone again. So why didn't you feel you were enough for someone? You're such an accomplished person.
Well, I was also much younger then. Yeah. I sort of trying to find my way in the world. And I think there were expectations put on a 20-something woman that you need to get married and have kids. And I thought because I couldn't do that, that something was wrong with me. Now, writing this book sort of solidified the fact that not that I was stupid. I wouldn't call my previous self stupid. Mm-hmm. I just needed to travel a little bit further on my own journey, as they say, to realize that that's not the case. And running, I think, helped me find a lot of self-confidence that I didn't have before. I don't know if I would have let that happen to me at the time if I had been sort of part of this other social group, because running is community. You know, South Jersey Athletic Club, they're my people. I think I might have been a little bit stronger to say, you know, this isn't really right, and maybe have not gotten into that situation, or at least extra, you know, taken myself out earlier.
Yeah. Well, following your breakup with Steve, your grandfather passed away, and you seemed to have a mini breakdown.
Yeah. My grandparents lived less than a mile away, and it was just sort of like hammering one thing after the other. You know, I lost this relationship, which had started well. I mean, it was still a loss, even though it was toxic and terrible. And then, you know, one of the most important people in my life passed away, and he had been sick for a long time, so it wasn't a surprise, but, you know, sort of things changing constantly. And he was so proud of me with everything that I did, too. And then my grandmother slipped into dementia. So there's all sorts of terrible things happening. And then I bought a house right before the housing market crashed, and I lost half my clients. And, you know, I think the one thing that really set me off was the washer broke in this brand new house that I bought, new to me. And I just couldn't get up off the floor anymore.
And so your mom gently suggests therapy, and instead you go for a 10-miler.
I did.
That was the beginning of it.
Yeah, I had very terrible self-employed insurance at the time. This health insurance market was obviously different then and didn't cover mental health services. I get in trouble for saying I started running instead. Please get help if you need it. But I had stumbled across this 10-mile road race at the Jersey Shore while I was researching my first book, which was about the Jersey Shore. And I thought 10 miles is a pretty good challenge. And I've run that race 9 years in a row now.
So through all this, it seems that your mom is kind of a North Star to you. She's at so many of your races. She's got the coach hat on. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you pack up and come home after whatever's going on in your life, she says, okay, and she changes the sheets. So what has your mom been to you at all of this?
Well, you know, I should add that my mom is a runner now. She's running the New Jersey Half Marathon on Sunday.
Good for
you. You know, it's easy to say that your mom's your inspiration, but, you know, as every, you know, teenager goes through hating their parents and why are you ruining my life and coming back to New Jersey after college and sort of seeing the life that my mom built for herself after divorce, and she didn't go to college. So, you know, it wasn't the easiest road to go. And what she's become has just been amazing and an inspiration. And, you know, when she started getting into running, I was nervous for her because, you know, she did finish last in her first 5K, but her outlook on it was, but I did it.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't matter. I did it. I did it. And she's done it 16 more times now. And, you know, it's sort of that, you know, go ahead no matter what attitude that helps me do what I do.
Do you run together in races at all?
Sometimes. Our paces are really different. I did a 5K, her second 5K I did with her. I was hurt. So I did it with her just to go out and do it because it's in her town. And she wanted to run with me. But sometimes we run together, most of the times not.
Let me reintroduce you. Jen Miller is author of Running, A Love Story, and the number is 888-477-9499. You can also send us an email at WHYY Radio Times if you'd like to get in on the conversation. So, Jen, how is a long run different from a short run when it comes to kind of a holistic therapy? I mean, you talk about just kind of having that blank mind when you're going out and having a lot of creative time. So for you, what's the difference?
Well, track work, which is my shortest runs, when you sprint really hard and then stop and then sprint really hard, is more about finding the focus to get through it and go as fast as you can. A long run is about running at an even tempo pace or an even pace to get through the miles. And there's less pressure, I think, on you. Although going out to run 20 miles, there's a lot of pressure on you.
Sure.
But it's one of those things that you just get through 1 mile at a time, and it there's less, you know, franticness about it. And I think that's why people sort of get caught up in marathons and they collapse at the end. They get too frantic in the beginning, and just pacing things evenly and taking time to be by yourself and not rushing is what I like most about distance running. I like those long runs. I mean, it takes a lot of time, but you get to eat after too.
Well, do you take food with you?
I take shot blocks with me. But not like I'm going to go get pancakes after. Sometimes it's thinking.
What's a shot block for those who are uninitiated?
It's a little, they taste like the candy dots. Mm-hmm. Most people talk about goos.
Yeah.
Goos make me vomit. So I like these little square candies that really do. They taste like dots.
And they just give you a shot of glucose energy?
Glucose energy, carbohydrates, salt, and a little bit of caffeine.
Hmm. Okay. So people, of course, were running 20 years ago, but the running scene wasn't anything like it is now. You feel that since you've gotten into the sport, it's become more inclusive?
It has. The first running boom was in the 70s. It was mostly male. I've written for ESPNW about women in running, and one of the things I wrote about in January was that women started running more after Oprah did the Marine Corps Marathon, because she was a regular person. Not that Oprah's a regular person, but a regular athlete who went out and did this thing. After the recession, the popularity of running exploded, I think for the same reason that I latched onto it at longer distances, because it is not only just a physical activity, which is good for you, but it also lets you control something when things are really spiraling out of control. Women really picked up the baton during that time. We now run 61% of half marathons in the United States and 57% of all road races in the United States, to the point that I was asked to write a magazine story, which unfortunately I couldn't do at the time, about how to attract men to running. So women of all ages, shape, sizes, I think, has really opened the doors to maybe men who thought they were too old to run or too big to run or too small to run. Or, you know, you see everybody out there now at your town 5K. Yeah.
And fascinating, because in a few minutes we're going to have we'll welcome Bobby Gibb to the show.
Yes.
In just a moment. She was the lone woman in the Boston Marathon 50 years ago. So
she
we'll
was.
Talk about that. So, Jenna, it's kind of a personal question as we wrap up this segment of the show. You know, you're very open about your relationships and with your book, in your book. Are you single as we speak? And if so, are you okay with being single now?
I have a boyfriend. Okay. I say that I'm single sometimes because I'm not married. And he reminded me, like, no, you have a boyfriend. Just because of semantics thing.
Yeah.
He's great. You know, I would be okay without him, though. Like, I'm possibly buying a new house, and it's for me. That sort of thing. You know, I had a friend, a very well-meaning friend, say, well, why don't you wait until you're in a relationship before you decide what to do with your house? I'm like, that seems silly. Like, would you say that to a guy? So.
Okay. Jen Miller is author of the memoir Running, A Love Story. She's with us the full hour of Radio Times. And joining us after the break, Roberta Gibb, the first woman to run the Boston Marathon. And that was 50 years ago this month. And as always, we invite you to join the conversation. 888-477-9499 is the number. Our email, radiotimes@whyy.org. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscowain. Radio Times continues in just a moment. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscowain. Running is our focus this hour. The number is 888-477-9499. Our email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Well, it was just over a week ago that Ethiopia's Atseda Besa won the women's race in the Boston Marathon with a time of 2:29:19, nearly 50 years to the day after Bobby Gibb became the first woman to race and finish Boston. Well, Bobby Gibb was present as Atseda Besa collected her trophy. We'll get to that story in just a moment. But first, it is our pleasure to welcome Bobby Gibb to Radio Times. Hi, Bobby.
Well, hi, Mary. Hi, Mary. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's great to have you here. And Jen Miller is along as well. We've been discussing her memoir, Running, A Love Story.
Hey, Bobby.
Hi, Jen. I read your book.
Oh, good. Hey. Thank you.
So, and I know, Jen, you've actually interviewed Bobby on another occasion, so we all know each other. So, Bobby, let's talk about then and now. You finished Boston at a time in which it was believed women were not physically capable of running the marathon distance. Give us a sense of what the expectation for women in sport was then from your perspective going into this.
Well, when I grew up in the 50s and 60s, opportunities for women were extremely limited, and the type of gender-specific life that women were required to lead was very limited. And as an adolescent coming into womanhood, I was fuming at this and rebelling against it. I said, if this sort of being in a cage, you were very limited. You couldn't even have a credit card in your own name. Hmm. And it was very difficult to have a profession. You were not expected to work outside of the home. You were expected to stay home and be a housewife and put your husband and your children's needs ahead of your own, which is fine. I wanted to be married and I wanted to have children. But I also wanted to develop my mind and my body as I saw fit.
How did you come to decide to run the marathon?
Well, I always loved to run, even as a child. I'd see a green field shimmering in the sun, and I just run full speed across the field. And I had a sense of joy and a sense of life and a sense of autonomy and freedom that was rare for a girl. And then everyone else stopped running, and I just kept on running. I would run in the woods with the neighborhood dogs, which was extremely abnormal for a grown woman to run. And to run in public was just improper.
Well, and what did you run in? I'm curious because, you know, Asics and Brooks and those, they weren't around then, were they?
I had nurse's shoes, which were the only sturdy woman's shoes I could find. They were flat and made of leather and very sturdy and good for running. And then I wore a tank top bathing suit underneath as underwear. And then over that, depending on the season, I wore shorts in the summer, or I'd wear layers and layers of sweatpants and sweatshirts and parkas and so forth in the winter, which I would peel off as I became hotter and hotter running.
And you were comfortable in those clothes?
Yeah, actually. Yes, I was.
So, yeah. Bobby, if you could give us a sense of Boston Marathon race day 1966, what was the atmosphere like as you are preparing to jump into this race?
Well, first of all, it was an all-men's race. It was a men's division race. There was no women's division race. I had actually written the Boston Athletic Association to get an application in February of 1966, and they wrote back and said women were not physiologically able to run marathons. Mm-hmm. They couldn't take the liability, the medical liability, and besides, it was a men's division race, and of course, women aren't qualified to run men's division races. And the longest sanctioned run for a woman was a mile and a half. Hmm. So when I decided I was going to run anyway, because I saw this was an opportunity to change the way people thought about women, the way women thought about themselves and the way men thought about women, I thought, if I can show this false belief about women wrong, I'll throw into question all the other false beliefs about women. I wanted to make a social change, and this was just the very, very, very beginnings of that. So when I got to Boston on race day, I knew I was doing something I wasn't supposed to do, and I was somewhere I wasn't supposed to be, and I thought I would be arrested.
Really?
I knew if the officials saw me, they'd throw me out. So I was running around trying to figure out how I could get into this race. I mean, how could I prove I could do something that I wasn't allowed to do? That was the catch-22.
Let me bring Jen back into the conversation here. Jen, it's almost inconceivable that, you know, jumping into the race, Bobby had to watch for the police in this day and age.
Well, and I wrote about Bobby for ESPNW, and just talking about, you know, hiding in the bushes. And Bobby, what did you share what your parents thought?
Well, I took a bus. I was living in San Diego at that time. I took a Greyhound bus back across the country. I arrived the day before the race. I called my parents from Boston, and they said, well, where are you? I said, Boston. They said, what are you doing in Boston? And I said, I'm going to run the Boston Marathon. They actually thought I was nuts. They thought I was mentally ill. My father thought that I was delusional. Somehow, poor girl, she thinks she's going to run the marathon, because I had not shared with them the fact that I had trained for this race for 2 years. I trained every single day for this race. And at that time, I was running 40 miles at a stretch. But I knew if I shared that with my parents, they would try to stop me. So I never told my parents. I told my girlfriend, my best girlfriend and my boyfriend, but my parents didn't know. So this came out of the blue for them.
So, Bobby Gibb, you eventually hide behind some forsythia bushes. That's what I've read. And you jump in, and eventually you are found out by fellow runners, all of whom are men. What were their reactions?
Well, this was a crucial point in the race. And I have to say, it was only a few minutes after I jumped out of the bushes, the men behind me, I could hear them murmur, is that a girl? Is that a girl? They were studying my anatomy from the mirror. I was extremely impressed by how quickly they figured this out, despite my brother's bulky Bermudas and my hooded sweatshirt that I was disguised in. They quickly saw a female anatomy, so I turned around and smiled, knowing that I had to keep this upbeat and positive and non-threatening, and they said, oh, it is a girl. Gee, I wish my girlfriend would run. I wish my wife would run. So these men were very supportive, and when I said, if I take off my sweatshirt, my hooded sweatshirt, and and they see I'm a woman, I'm afraid they'll throw me out, and they said, we won't let them.
I had a... Sorry, Bobby. I had interviewed a man who ran that year. He's run the Boston Marathon 30 times now, I think. And he said that you have to remember that it wasn't the big thing that it was then. So, Bobby, you were ahead of him, and he heard the spectators like whisper down the lane saying, there's a girl, there's a girl. And he was like, ooh, this is interesting. I want to get to the end and see what's going on.
Huh. Wow.
Well, yeah, there's a local radio station broadcasting my progress along the course, and of course the press saw history in the making here, and they were phoning ahead. And so by the time I got to Wellesley College, which is about halfway through the race, all the women were looking for me. They knew I was coming.
And what was their reaction?
They just went crazy. They screamed and yelled and jumped up into the air and crying and laughing. And one woman, an older woman over the side with a number of children around her, was going, Ave Maria, Ave Maria. And there were tears streaming down her face. And it's like at that moment, we all knew at that moment, it was never going to be the same for women again. They could never again put us back in that little box into which we'd been crammed for so long.
Bobby Gibb,
something changed. Something changed right then.
At one point on the course, you did lock eyes with a policeman, but he actually encouraged you?
Yeah, he said, "Atta go, girlie, atta go." And some of them were saying, yeah, hurry up and catch him. He went that away. So the police were very friendly. I mean, the police are wonderful.
So Jen has spoken of the pain she endured in her first marathons. Bobby Gibb, did you have a similar experience running Boston?
Well, not at first. At first, I was running well, much slower than I usually did on my training runs, because I knew I had a great responsibility resting on my shoulders. And if I failed to finish or collapsed or something, this would set women back 50 or 100 years. Who knows? So I was being very conservative in my running. And the men around me, I didn't have a watch, but according to them, we were actually on a sub-3-hour marathon, and I was running very easily. I was extremely well-trained. I'd run up over the Rocky Mountains, and I can tell you in a minute how I trained for this thing. I was running up and down mountains and across deserts and so forth. So I was in very, very good shape. So I was just cruising along, feeling wonderful. There gets to be a point when you're running like that where you feel as though you can go on and on forever, and it's just this beautiful meditation. It's like a bird flying. And up until about mile 17, that's the way I was feeling. I kept trying to rein myself back. And then we hit Heartbreak Hill, and that wasn't difficult for me. I went up and then up again and up again, the way it goes in layers like that. But then coming down the other side, what was beginning to happen was my new boys' running shoes were giving me blisters. I had horrendous blisters, and they were beginning to break through, and they were bleeding, and they were raw. And so my feet were hurting me, and the soles of these running shoes were much thinner than the nurse's shoes, and I wasn't used to running on pavement, so my feet began to really hurt. And also, I didn't know you're supposed to drink water, so I had drunk no water for the entire race, and it was quite a hot day. And I had eaten a huge amount of roast beef the night before, which is still sitting in my stomach and was beginning to cause me a little bit of discomfort.
And wait, where were you on the course, Bobby?
Well, this was by the time I got to Heartbreak Hill, I was beginning to feel this, which is not very far from the finish, actually. And so I came down the last 3 miles of the race. My feet were so painful, I was literally tiptoeing along. I was tiptoeing along. It hurt to put each foot down. I didn't stop, but my pace dropped way off. And then, so I actually was starting to feel like a failure in those last few miles. And I wondered if anyone was still going to be there at the finish.
But you crossed the finish line. So what was going
on? But you asked if I had been in pain. Well, only in those last few miles. Yeah. So then, I went down Hereford Street, and I turned on the Boylston Street, and wow, everybody was still there. The bleachers were filled, and there was the crowds were yelling, and the press was there, and I ran down that last stretch, and the governor of Massachusetts, John Volpe, came down and shook my hand, and the people from the press all crowded around me and interviewed me, and actually, it was front page headlines.
Jen?
And that a girl had done the impossible and run the Boston Marathon. So,
and you beat two-thirds of the field, right?
Well, I wasn't in the race to beat anybody. I wasn't trying to beat the men. I was trying to run with the men. I wanted to show that men and women can do things together, and there doesn't have to be this competition and this stupid war between the sexes, that men and women can enjoy all of life together and meet all of life's challenges together. And just depending on the individual and the individual's propensities and gifts and so forth, and not have to fit ourselves or each other into these stereotypical gender categories or race categories or ethnicity categories, that we can all just be individuals.
Bobby, when you crossed the finish line, what was going through your head? Do you remember?
Well, it was a tremendous sense of accomplishment. And this was the end of a two-year journey that I had started in 1964 when I first saw the marathon and fell in love with it. And I had, during those 2 years, my training took me on a 3,000-mile journey across this whole continent, running during the days at a different place and at night sleeping out under the stars. And that was a spiritual journey as well as a physical conditioning. And so this incredible sense of accomplishment, and I have always had a sense of love and a sense of love of life and a sense of being immersed in nature and life. And this was the feeling that I was bringing back to Boston and sharing with everyone, that everybody can do this.
Bobby Gibb, so at the finish line this year, or I should say during the trophy event, Atseda Besa, the winner of the women's race, offered you her trophy.
That was so moving. And that was a culmination of an entire week, weekend, what I would only call a giant love fest. There were people there from all over the world, over 90 nations, all ethnic groups, all political persuasions, all races, and both genders, of course. And there were no barriers, no boundaries between us. We were hugging each other and laughing and crying. And this woman is so full of love. And she heard my story, and she was moved to tears. And she was so moved that she said that she was going to give her trophy to me. And I was moved to tears. I was crying, and there was not a dry eye in the press room. It was just a beautiful, beautiful gesture from this beautiful woman. And, you know, there's just a bond of love between us. And I said, well, I can't really keep this. I will keep this for a year in your honor, but then I will return it to you in Ethiopia. And she said through an interpreter, yes. So this is the plan. We're going to get together in Ethiopia. I'm going to bring her trophy.
Wow, what a neat story. So we're just at the end of the hour here, Bobby Gibb. But, you know, but from what you started 50 years ago to Jen's running the marathon on Sunday, the New Jersey Marathon. So yeah, wonderful story. Thank you both so much for joining us here on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Bobby Gibb, a true pleasure, a trailblazer for women in distance running. And also, we didn't get time to talk about the fact that you're a sculptor as well. And Jen Miller, marathoner, writer, and author of Running, A Love Story, 10 years, 5 marathons, and 1 life-changing sport. And Jen's also on the team writing the new New York Times Well Running newsletter. Thanks so much for joining us, and good luck on Sunday.
Thank you.
Remember, visit our Facebook page here at Radio Times, and we've got podcasts as well. Head to whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producer is Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Elizabeth Fiedler. And our intern today, Nick Kowalski. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. Thanks so much for joining us, Radio Times.